Who, according to you, has been the most iconic finance minister of India?
Well, without doubt, it's Manmohan Singh. Manmohan Singh was truly a finance minister who changed Indian economy. And at the same time, he faced a lot of controversies also. Kharpur, he was brought in because...
And brought in by whom?
Brought in by Mrs. Gandhi's government during emergency time. Yeah. And one of the first things that Kharpur did was to approve loan for Sanjay Gandhi's Maruti project.
It was Sanjay Gandhi who brought in Maruti?
Absolutely. The original creator of Maruti was Sanjay Gandhi's idea of a small car project.
It was owned by him?
Yeah, owned by him, yeah. Absolutely.
Binny Bansal moved to Singapore. What could have Indian government done to have incentivized them to be here?
Raghuram Rajan was appointed by the UPA government. Yeah. But I think their relationship with Narendra Modi government was strained. The point I'm making is this, whether it is this government or the previous governments, whether it is the Morarji Desai government or it's the Nehru government, the tensions and stressful relations between the RBI and the RBI governor and the finance ministry and the prime minister is a story that is an ongoing saga.
Hi, this is Siddharth Ahluwalia. Welcome to The Neon Show. Today, I'm glad to bring you some of the most interesting stories of Indian Finance Ministry. This is a ministry behind the economic reforms that has taken place in India. And I have today with me Ashok Bhattacharya, Editorial Director, Business Standard, and the author of India's Finance Minister.
Hello, Siddharth. How are you?
So glad to have you on the Neon Show today.
Me too.
I'm very excited to dive into some of these stories, right? And for our audience to go back into the history of Indian economic reforms. Today we are especially going to talk about the volume 2 of your book, which captures the Indian Finance Ministry between 1977 to 1998. But we'll also go a little bit forward and backward both ways, right? Because, where we are today is all courtesy to what we have done previously, both positive and negative, as India. So what is the role of finance ministry in India? First, I would just like for our audience to dive deep into that before I go into granular details.
Well, the finance ministry is a very critical arm of the government. And as you would know that a government cannot run without running its finances well. And running its finances is possible if you can manage your resources well. And how do you manage your resources is by taxing people, companies, services, goods, etc. And how well you can spend those resources that you have collected through taxes and non-tax revenues on various schemes and various projects, So therefore, the finance minister is at the center of this very critical initiative, that how do you raise resources for the government and how do you manage to spend them? Now, please remember that finance ministry as such is not just an instrument of economic policy making. There is a lot of political economy initiatives that this ministry takes. In the sense that it is not a question of implementing the new tax rates or planning new expenditure programs, but it is also about what kind of programs need to be introduced and in what manner you can raise those resources, whether you want to tax the rich or whether you want to give a lot of benefits to the poor. So therefore, a finance minister has to be completely in tune with the political ideology or the political vision of the party as well as in party in power as well as the prime minister. So I have seen that in the last so many 75, 76 years, the equation between the prime minister and the finance minister becomes very, very critical, because the finance minister is not just about rupees and dollars. The finance ministry is also about how do you make sure that the political ideology of a government, the ruling party, is implemented most optimally and in a way that the government gets more bang for the buck.
Yeah. And who, according to you, has been the most iconic finance minister of India?
Well, without doubt, it's Manmohan Singh. Not just because he implemented the 100-day reforms that were not only necessary, overdue reforms, but also if those reforms had not been introduced, then the Indian economy would have been a different story. The growth that you saw after them, after those changes, is something that we all as Indians are very proud of. And the interesting thing is what Manmohan Singh did in those five budgets, the broad tenor of those policies have been maintained even now. So the reforms, the direction that he gave to the Indian economy, that have by and large been followed. Yes, there have been changes, deviations, some sort of rollback has also happened. For example, in the tariff policy, there is some rethinking going on, some sort of subsidies for economic production, like the production linked incentive schemes. There are some rethinking going on, but the broad tenor of government should not be in the business of running businesses, that has been accepted. So that is Manmohan Singh's biggest contribution. And the second biggest contribution of Manmohan Singh has been the way he built a team of expertise in the finance ministry. We did not see it in any other time. Any other finance ministry could build that kind of resources. So his team was actually, the dream team that he created to implement economic policies. And that team was such that it could differ with the finance minister, and the finance minister will recognize those differences and will try to bring on board those differences and resolve those differences, reconcile those differences and frame policies. He was not unwilling, Manmohan Singh was not unwilling to take back his policies. There have been many instances where he has announced something and then he has modified his stance. Take the question of he wanted to set up a tariff commission. Now, tariff commission was never set up under him. He realized that the tariff commission in the Indian context could actually raise tariffs instead of bringing tariffs down. So he almost gave the idea of a tariff commission a decent burial. He also gave a lot of legislative power to institutions. The Securities and Exchange Board of India was set up by V.P. Singh, his predecessor, the finance minister, but it didn't have the statutory power. Manmohan Singh decided to give it a statutory power. He decided to bring in insurance reforms. He could not see to its implementation, but he was the man who decided on it. He decided to bring in the idea that the government should not have a free check as far as it meeting its deficits are concerned. It must go out to the market and borrow money through the RBI, Reserve Bank of India, and meet its deficit. Good old days, what used to happen is that the government could issue ad hoc treasury bills and the RBI will use them and give money to the government. So essentially nothing else but printing currency notes.
What US is doing right now.
Yeah, exactly. So now Manmohan Singh decided to impose this restraint on his own government. Said, no, this is not good. So he mooted it, he introduced the idea, and then his successor, Chidambaram, implemented it in 1997. So I think that era has seen these huge reforms, but at the same time, that era also saw a big stock market scandal,
yeah,
in which the finance minister, Manmohan Singh, the iconic finance minister, went through real tough, troubling times. He was called by the securities committee, that inquiry committee, the joint parliamentary committee that looked into the security scam. It found that the finance minister was sleeping finance minister. And he was deeply aggrieved. He had put in his papers and Narasimha Rao was not in a position to accept that. He sat on that paper and would not respond to Manmohan Singh. But Manmohan Singh had stopped going to his office.
Okay.
And then the Prime Minister went to Parliament. After that debate, he announced that, Manmohan Singh is not guilty. He has not made any money or anything on this. And I have told him that he should continue as the Finance Minister of the country. And that's how the controversy ended. So Manmohan Singh was truly a finance minister who changed India, changed Indian economy. And at the same time, he faced a lot of controversies also.
And can you tell us more, as you mentioned in your book, about this scandal, like what happened and how did Manmohan Singh get involved in it?
Well, Manmohan Singh was not involved.
Yeah.
It was under the watch of Manmohan Singh as the finance minister that stock market operators led by Harshad Mehta, they used the banking system to raise loans against what is called the banker's receipts and play the stock market. So what was happening was the stock market was bullish. The stock prices were going up. But the fueling of the stock market was largely because of these stock market operators using the banking sector money to buy up stocks. The mistake of the finance minister was to have made a statement in parliament that a finance minister cannot lose his sleep just because the stock market price is going up or going down. He did ask his officers, ask SEBI, to look into the causes of this sharp spike, but he did not follow up adequately enough. And simultaneously what happened was, when the security scam came out, the stock markets fell, there were this allegation by Harshad Mehta that he had given money, 1 crore rupees, in his suitcase to the Prime Minister at his residence. Now, it was an allegation that was made by Harshad Mehta. So it became a political controversy. It was an economic controversy. And Manmohan Singh's failure was not to have anticipated it, not to have taken adequate steps in preventing that scam, instead probably letting it continue for a while. So I think he was found wanting in the role of a finance minister in addressing the queries. But there was no need for him to resign, because personally he was absolutely clean, he was honest. But the argument was that even if a scam takes place under your charge, the finance minister should be morally responsible. So that was why there was this demand that Manmohan Singh should quit. There was instances cited, and which I have referred to in my first volume, about T.T. Krishnamachari, another finance minister, who had apparently had allowed life insurance corporation's money to be loaned to a stock market operator called Haridas Mundra, so that he could shore up his stock prices. Now, even then, there was a committee that was set up. The Chagla Commission was set up. And the Chagla Commission found that the finance minister was not guilty of making money, but he cannot be fully exonerated because of responsibility. So, at that time, Nehru accepted T.T. Krishnamachari's resignation. In this case, when Manmohan Singh put in his papers after the JPC report, Narasimha Rao did not accept the resignation. So that's the difference. Of course, critics would say that Manmohan Singh should not have continued beyond that. But I think at that point in time, as long as there was no clear proof of his having done something malafide, I don't think there should have been any reason to believe that he should quit.
And coming back to this, the LIC scam that happened earlier, there was a once finance secretary that you mentioned in your book that had to bear the brunt.
Yes.
And then he took his revenge 20 years later. Would love to
know that. Well, you know, you are right. it seems that you have read the book. H.M. Patel was the finance secretary at that time. And T.T. Krishnamachari's fault, I would say, was that he let his finance secretary face the heat.
Yeah. He named him.
He named him. Yeah. He named him. So as a result, H.M. Patel had to go through a commission of inquiry. And finally, the Vivian Bose committee finally exonerated him. But that was much after his entire career as a civil servant came to a very abrupt end. So H.M. Patel became a politician later. He joined the Swatantra Party. And then when 1977, when Janata Party came to power, he from Banaskantha, I think, H.M. Patel won his election. And who did Morarji Desai make his finance minister? He made H.M. Patel the finance minister. And he walked into the same room from where he was banished, sat as the finance secretary. So it's ironical that H.M. Patel there. And then, you know, there are very, very interesting anecdotes. H.M. Patel presided over, independent India's first demonetization as a finance minister. He did not agree with the idea of demonetizing those currencies. But the Prime Minister said, Morarji Desai, nothing doing. He went ahead and did it. So as a finance minister, he carried out his orders. Maybe somewhat like what Mr. Modi's demonetization decision was in 2016, where the finance minister may not have fully agreed, but it was the Prime Minister's order. So which is why I come back to my original theme, that the Prime Minister and the finance minister, they work in tandem. And this equation between the finance minister and the prime minister is something that needs to be examined in close quarters and detail if you want to understand the political economy and its progress and trajectory in India.
So can you tell us more about the interesting the first demonetization of India? And how did our government, when it implemented second time, learn from the first one?
Well, there are a lot of differences between the two. The first demonetization, when Morarji Desai got it done, was a demonetization that was not done through an executive order. Demonetization can be done also through an executive order. Now at that time, Morarji Desai felt that high value currencies, I think it was 5,000 rupees, they needed to be demonetized because a lot of black money, he believed, was being generated because of the use of 5,000. But remember, 5,000 rupee note was a very small portion of the total currency in circulation at that time. Very, very small. But in spite of that, Morarji Desai and H.M. Patel decided to go the parliament route. They decided to issue an ordinance in consultation with the RBI, and then they use the RBI Act to issue an ordinance, and then the ordinance became law. Ordinance because it had to happen one midnight. There was not much, there were no disruption of that sort, because it was a very small portion of the total money in circulation. Now, what happened in 2016, the two differences, one was that it was not through an ordinance. It was through the RBI's own power. Its board met, and there the board received a note from the finance ministry saying that this is what needs to be done. And then the board met and decided on going ahead with demonetizing the 1,000 rupee and 500 rupee notes, which accounted for more than 86% of the total currency in circulation. So it was a huge thing. So there are two big differences. One was a very small share in the currency in circulation, and it was done through the legislative route. So there was far less controversy because it was done through parliament. And this one was one, it was 86% of the total currency in circulation. So the disruption were much, much, much huge. And it was done through an RBI board decision.
I want to come to one other interesting story that you mentioned in your book, right? During Rajiv Gandhi's tenure, between two tenures, he had more than four finance ministers.
Yes.
And he himself took over finance ministry in 1987. Tell us more about that.
Well, you know, that's a very unfortunate era. You know, Rajiv Gandhi began very well. as a man who, the only party who got 400 plus seats in the Lok Sabha in 1984. Of course, Mrs. Gandhi's assassination had given him that edge, in the sense that there was a sympathy wave working in favor of Congress and Rajiv Gandhi. And he also had promised a clean government, that he will attack the brokers and the, you know, power brokers in the system and all that. So he was the Mr. Clean. That was his reputation. So, but VP Singh was his finance minister. He accepted that logic of the prime minister, that you must be clean and you must bring in, you know, honest dealings and everything. He also, of course, was a politician at heart. So what VP Singh did was, he used his powers as a finance minister to introduce a lot of, I would say, coercive measures to discipline erring businessmen. So there was what is called a raid raj. He started raiding businessmen. He even arrested well-known industrialists like S.L. Kirloskar. So it caused a lot of damage to industry's confidence in a government. There were also powerful industry leaders. You know, there was Dhirubhai Ambani at that time, who also came under attack from Mr. V.P. Singh. So he built his bridges with Rajiv Gandhi. So VP Singh, in spite of having done a wonderful stint as a finance minister, having introduced the famous long-term fiscal policy, introduced the first step that led to the goods and services tax in 2017, was done by VP Singh by introduction of MODVAT, Modified Value Added Tax. So VP Singh, as a finance minister, he introduced many good things, but the raid raj created a lot of problems, and then Rajiv Gandhi could not take that anymore, and he decided to remove him. And remove him when? Remove him less than 4 weeks before the budget presentation. One fine morning, VP Singh was called by Rajiv Gandhi, saying that, you know, there is a border skirmishes going on, and I want you to be the defense minister.
Okay.
So, and who was the defense minister at that time? Rajiv Gandhi himself.
Yeah.
So, VP Singh must have wondered that, you know, who is a better defense minister to take charge of the situation than the prime minister himself. So clearly it was politically motivated. So he was shifted to defense ministry, and Rajiv Gandhi himself became the finance minister. Broadly, the budget that he presented was prepared by VP Singh. But he left finance ministry Rajiv Gandhi by, I think, July or August in that year, that is 1986. But then the Bofors controversy had erupted. He was under attack. VP Singh decided to quit the government and started his own party. There were a lot of problems in the Congress party at that time. So Rajiv Gandhi decided to get, one year after, got different ministers, and they were all ministers, finance ministers, who would be very forgettable finance ministers. That is a phrase I can use for them. Now, you had N.D. Tiwari, who came and became famous for giving tax relief for bindis, you know, rural women use bindis, so he gave tax relief to them. So very socialistic bent of mind. So from VP Singh's you know, forward-looking reformist budgets, N.D. Tiwari's budget was a very socialistic budget. Then came S.B. Chavan. He's also, but what had happened then was that, while the investments had to be kept going, the finance minister started borrowing money. So the borrowing that went on after VP Singh's departure to keep the investments going, so the government's borrowing debt levels began rising, and because of the oil prices going up and our exports not doing that well, imports rising, our balance of payments problem got worse. So that is what drove us to the crisis of the late 1989. So when again VP Singh came back as the Prime Minister and was done with the Finance Minister, they were not really up to the task of managing the situation. They went for the IMF loan. They could not get a proper IMF loan. They got a gold tranche loan of a very small amount. And IMF told them very clearly, imagine the situation.
Yeah.
They tell the Indian government that, listen, you have a stable government. If the stable government can give us the confidence, that they will implement reforms, then I will be able to give you loans. So even the VP Singh government fell. Who came? Chandrasekhar came. There was another finance minister who brought in Yashwant Sinha. Good finance minister. He made a lot of good promise in his interim budget of disinvestment, privatization. But then that was an interim budget. That government too fell. Elections were called. Rajiv Gandhi was assassinated. So, you know, you can see how politics became also fragile. So because of that, to a great extent, the Congress could amass the largest number of seats, but it was not a majority party. And then Manmohan Singh became the finance minister, Narasimha Rao was the prime minister. But remember, those in 100 days of major decision making to bail the Indian economy out of that twin challenges, which is the balance of payments and the fiscal indiscipline, both Narasimha Rao and Manmohan Singh were not elected to parliament at that time. They got elected to parliament only later in the year of 1991. But the crisis was such that nobody raised or made that an issue that, hey, you are implementing these decisions, but first get elected to parliament. So, you know, so they had they used that provision in the law that for 6 months, you can be a minister. And Narasimha Rao was a minister, prime minister for 6 months without being elected. So he was, so therefore it is very important to recognize that when politics is fragile and economy is in crisis, and if the government has made up its mind to take big and bold decisions, it can, it does, and it did.
And also wanted to talk about, like, just before Rajiv Gandhi's era, there was Sanjay Gandhi, right, when Indira Gandhi was in power. And Sanjay Gandhi, as you mentioned in the book, was very high-handed with the finance ministry.
Oh, yes. Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I think VP, R. Venkatraman was a very mild-mannered finance minister. And Sanjay Gandhi was very powerful, but unfortunately for Mrs. Gandhi, unfortunately for R. Venkatraman, Sanjay Gandhi met with an accident and died in June 1980. So from 1980, his first budget and first few months, Venkatraman had a major tough time with Sanjay Gandhi's intervention. And he would often call for files, and he would interfere in his functioning. So much so that Venkatraman was also the industry minister, and they were industrial policy liberalization was being mooted. But Sanjay Gandhi decided that Venkatraman is not listening to him. So he got hold of one of his cronies, Charanjit Chanana, as the Minister of State for Industry, so that files could be cleared, even though R. Venkatraman, the industry minister, is not in favor of it. So it was a very difficult time, but as I said, the Sanjay Gandhi died in an accident, and Venkatraman was relieved. But his relief was short-lived. The balance of payment problem had begun at that time. And India was forced to go in for the largest loan given to any country. It was around over $5 billion loan. You know, now why did India go for the loan? Because India's repayment capacity was under question. So international loan had to be repaid. So when they wanted to go for the loan, the finance minister was not happy about it. The finance minister did not even moot the idea. It was the idea mooted by India's representative in the World Bank. M. Narasimha, former RBI governor, he mooted the idea. He came and he met not the finance minister, but the Prime Minister Indira Gandhi.
Yeah.
And Indira Gandhi said, if you think that we need the IMF loan, why don't you draft a note for me? So Narasimham drafted a note and left it with the Prime Minister. And when Narasimham came back to India later, he found the same note was endorsed and sent by the finance minister. In other words, what I am saying is this, that the story is getting repeated.
Yeah.
That it is the prime ministers who take a very, very important calls and the finance ministers implement them. And the equation between the finance minister and the prime minister are very, very important. I mean, whether it is a question of setting up the planning commission or whether it is a question of taking an IMF loan or whether it is a question deciding to devalue currency. The equation between the Prime Minister and the Prime Minister and the Prime Minister and the Finance Minister are very, very important.
And you would consider the 1991 team, right, which was P.V. Narasimha Rao, Mr. Manmohan Singh, and then an extended team of Montek Singh Ahluwalia,
Shankar Acharya, S.C. Rangarajan as the Deputy Governor.
The best team ever India had?
I think at that time it was a matter of, I think, sheer good luck also. You had such a integrated team that everybody was chipping in with his or her thinking. And Montek Singh Ahluwalia played the role of persuading people with his gentle, human relations skills, and things happened.
I think also what had happened is several NRIs during that time, like for example Sam Pitroda, they had become powerful enough to contribute back.
Absolutely, absolutely. There were, the first budget of Manmohan Singh, there was a scheme by which you could actually get NRI money into the country. I mean, many governments have tried to tap NRIs, like even the current government does that. Manmohan Singh was probably the second finance minister to have to NRI. The first one was Pranab Mukherjee, and it landed in trouble. You will remember the Swaraj, Paul, and Escorts takeover battle.
Yeah.
That was the first time that a finance minister tried to get NRI into the country, and he allowed NRIs to acquire shares in Indian companies without any limit. So when the takeover issue had blown up, so the government has to beat a hasty retreat and they imposed a cap of NRI investments through portfolio investments up to 5% or something like that. That was the first time. And the second time, Manmohan Singh got not the share transaction rate, but got the NRI deposits. NRIs could really put money into Indian bonds. That was allowed. And then again, Yashwant Sinha did it again in 1999. Again, he tapped the NRIs. So I think NRIs is also a recurrent theme in India's budgets and India's finance ministers, the way they have dealt with them.
So let's say the goal of this conversation is one, to reflect back and learn. The counterpart countries of India like Singapore, China, right? They never let momentum go in the last roughly 40 years, right? From 1970s or 80s, I would say. But India has almost every 5 to 6 years stop in this momentum. Why was that so that India could never run a momentum for at least a decade or two?
Well, I think one reason could be that we are a democracy, a very functioning democracy, and when people are unhappy, powerful segments in among the voters are unhappy, then there is a pushback. So it's a function of the government also to enlighten, to make people aware of the benefits or the short-term pains and the long-term gains of any economic reforms. You take a look at even the Narendra Modi government. Now, it did try to reform land laws. It did try to do reform the labor laws. Land reform laws were withdrawn. Labor laws have been passed, but not to be notified yet. The farm sector laws, they were very reform-oriented laws, but they had to be rolled back.
Yeah.
Now, why? Because of the pushback and the fear of the political capital of the party being undermined. Now, it is important that we keep the momentum on growth intact, but along with that, we also have to keep the reforms momentum also intact. Because if you don't keep the reforms momentum intact, then how do you make sure investments keep taking place? How do you make sure that now, for example, right now we are talking about judicial reform so that decision-making process is easier. The BJP's manifesto talks about judicial reforms, e-courts and everything. Now the question is, if this faces resistance from the vested interests, for example, there will be many, many, many lawyers. They may not like it. You know, for example, many people may not like it. So if they face resistance, I would say that our growth momentum may take a hit. So it's a very tough journey. So what happened in the 1990s was that because the governments were coalition governments, they were not strong governments, so they could probably experiment with many economic reforms. But from the 2000s onwards, governments have been
10-year
duration. Even the UPA was 10 years, then NDA has already completed another 10 years. So in such a situation, risk-taking probably takes a backseat. And I think that while it's good for the polity, the democracy, but it is not always necessarily good for economy.
But how do you, let's say, now the challenge for our listeners is that why can't you, in theory at least, decouple economic reforms with what I would say, things that will get you back into power?
Yeah. Well, you know, it's an impossibility. You know, I mean, if you want to be Singapore, you can do that.
Yeah.
But the choice is that if you become Singapore, then you will lose your democratic environment. You will lose democracy as an important thing. I mean, Singapore is a democracy, but it is a different kind of democracy. It's not like the Indian Indian democracy is chaotic, but yet it is very lively, functioning democracy, I would say, even now. So it's important to take that call that probably democracy has its own costs. I would say if you want to delink the pace of economic reforms from politics, the two critical elements which any government should pay attention to, and your viewers should probably take note of, is that come what may, that education and health, they must be taken care of by any government that comes to power adequately, so that we have healthy, nutritionally rich individuals growing up to be healthy citizens of this country. Number one. Number two is that you should have access to world-class education by which you become a graduate and also become employable. Now, there's a big difference between being a graduate and being employable. So if we could take care of these two elements, health and education, then I would say that we will reach a point where economic reforms will not be that big a stumbling block in our road to political democratic journey. And that's something which we all should recognize, that we should not give up our democratic path, the journey towards democracy, because that's something that we have earned very in the hard way. But at the same time, we cannot be a victim of the kind of disruptions that you're talking about,
yeah,
the kind of you know, the you become a prisoner, you know, in the hands of politics. So to prevent that, I would say focus has to come back on health and education so that people can sustain their growth, and then automatically the urge for reforms is expedited.
One area I would like to touch on the same note is, right, the 90 or 80% of the economy is made up of the top 20% people, and the Pareto's principle goes more hand in hand. Like, the 2% of the people would hold like 95% of the wealth, right? And India's history with taxation has been, you know, a bit chaotic, right? So what has continuously happened is, earlier the most rich global businessmen, for example, Lakshmi Niwas Mittal and other, right, Anil Agarwal, they would move outside India, better conditions for living, better lifestyle, but also better taxation, right? And still today, there are more countries getting developed. For example, the entire Middle East, right? They have become a haven for taxation for the rich, right? Singapore has always been a haven. So India has been losing the top capitalists always to these countries, right? So just want to understand.
Well, you know, it's a very important area that you have mentioned is a cause for concern. And I think, you know, the answer to that question, the answer to that problem, that if you want to solve that problem, will have to be that you have to take care of your domestic indigenous human resources. And how do you make sure that the riches don't belong to the top 20%? And the only way to make sure that it does not get concentrated like this is to enable ordinary citizens, ordinary Indians to have the best access to health and education, which will make them, not in this maybe generation, but the next generation will be able to be aspire for to become what you said, another Ellen Mittal or another Mukesh Ambani or another industrialist. So I think the key element is how do you strengthen the resources, the human resources, by beefing up health and education system. If that happens, I would say that this inequity or unequitable growth that you referred to probably can be handled over a period of maybe 20 years or so.
I'll give you a small example, right, before we further dive into the more of, you know, policy making. The recent generation of Indian billionaires who come from lower middle class include, let's say, Flipkart founders, Sachin Bansal and Benny Bansal, right? Now, you can't hold billionaires by force in a country that you can't give up your citizenship, or you can't, give up, you can't move your money. That's against democracy, and that against capitalism also, like free flow of capital. But India lost one of them to Singapore, like Binny Bansal moved to Singapore. And similarly, you know, we have seen many of Indian entrepreneurs at the time of exit move to Dubai, or Singapore. What could have, and you mentioned the other part of it, right? Creating health and education. What could have Indian government done to have incentivize them to be here rather than held them by force?
Well, you know, I will tell you, I agree that such talents should not ideally be allowed to go out
you,
of the
You can't force them.
But you can't force them either.
Yes.
You have to be believer in market forces.
Yes.
Now, if they have gone back, it is not gone out, does not necessarily mean they are gone out forever. They could well be not a brain drain, but they well could be the brain reserve. So if you can improve the conditions here a little more attractive, if you can make the taxation system, the overall ease of doing business better, if you can improve the judiciary better in terms of early decisions. And if you can create greater confidence in the system's ability to deliver both on health as well as education and on justice system, then I would say that there is no reason why Mr. Binny Bansal will not like to come back. The important challenge here is not to give up on the path of democracy, not on the path of free enterprise.
So now I want to talk about Reserve Bank of India, such an important institution. So what's the role of First Reserve Bank of India for our listeners?
Well, you know, the Reserve Bank of India is in charge of the Indian currency. Reserve Bank of India is in charge of banks. A lot of people look at Reserve Bank of India only as the banker's bank. But it is also an agency, the institution, independent agency that determines the government's credit allocation policy once upon a time and now the monetary policy. And since 2016, Reserve Bank of India is also looking at how inflation can be targeted to stay at 4% retail inflation so that people don't go through the travails of higher prices. Very important institution. It's a history of 90 years. It was set up by the British. The first RBI governor, Indian RBI governor, was C.D. Deshmukh, who also happened to be India's third finance minister. Over the years, however, there has been this debate that is RBI truly independent of the government, or is it an extension of the government? Now, the way we have seen RBI function vis-a-vis various Indian finance ministers as captured in the first volume as well as the second volume of India's finance ministers, it shows that, yes, on paper, RBI is an independent institution, a regulatory body, but it is not really autonomous. The best way which it describes its independence is that the RBI governor or the RBI is independent and autonomous, and it has the independence and the autonomy to say so from the government side. In a sense, the government says that you are independent and autonomous, but government has to say it. Now, we have seen how the government reacts to an RBI governor who shows signs of independence. There was this RBI governor who felt that the government's policies have played around and tinkered with the RBI's interest rate policies. Now, that time, the finance minister was T.T. Krishnamachari, and the RBI governor was the longest serving governor. The T.T. Krishnamachari, who was the finance minister, had taken a decision on bond prices in a manner that tinkered with the RBI's interest rate policy. So the governor at that time was Sir Benigal Rama Rao. He was not very happy with it, and he made it his displeasure and difference of opinion quite obvious, also because he felt that he was not consulted on this. Unfortunately, this led to a major difference of opinion and a kind of a fight between the finance minister and Sir Benigal Rama Rao.
And this is which year, sir?
This was in 1956-57. What happened was, since T.T. Krishnamachari called the RBI governor, and according to the Economic Affairs Secretary at that time, his account, the finance minister actually reprimanded the RBI governor. The RBI governor felt humiliated, and he went back to Bombay and held central bank's board of governors meeting and got a resolution adopted which questioned and expressed its displeasure over the way government has gone about this job and got that sent to the finance ministry. Now, Chidi Krishnamachari approached his prime minister. And you would imagine that the Prime Minister Jawaharlal Nehru would take the side of independent institution. Yeah. But he actually took the side of the finance minister.
Because Nehru has been autocratic.
Exactly. So he did, what he did was, he told the governor and said that you may be thinking that you are an autonomous institution, but remember you are an extension of the government. You are an arm of the government. And therefore, what you did by these resolutions and all that is not proper. And upon which Sir Benegal Rama Rao decided to quit. Now, he is still today the longest serving RBI governor. Now, that was the first.
And how long?
It was almost 7 years, 7 months or so. So that was the longest serving governor. So those of us who still have this belief that the RBI and the RBI governor are completely autonomous and independent should take a look at this incident involving Sir Benegal Rama Rao, Finance Minister T.T. Ramakrishnamachari and Prime Minister Jawaharlal Nehru.
And there's another interesting story that you covered in the book, right? How an RBI governor who was, not qualified to be an RBI governor, this head of LIC was bought in. And then 2 years later removed.
Absolutely. You are right. This is another story which I have there in the H.M. Patel's chapter when he was a finance minister. One of the first things that the finance minister told his banking secretary that what I want is that the RBI governor to resign. Please remember that, K.R. Puri was brought in by forcing the previous governor, Mr. Jagannathan, who actually decided to advance his departure.
Yes.
And joined the IMF. So K.R. Puri was brought in because
and brought in by whom?
Brought in by Mrs. Gandhi's government during emergency time. Yeah. This was the emergency year, and one of the first things that K.R. Puri did was to approve a loan for Sanjay Gandhi's Maruti project.
Yeah.
So
it was Sanjay Gandhi who brought in Maruti.
Absolutely, the original, the creator of Maruti was Sanjay Gandhi's idea of a small car project.
Tell us more about that story.
Well, Sanjay Gandhi was a person who took great interest in automotive industry, and even had gone to London to understand mechanical engineering in automotive sector. And then when he came back, he wanted to set up a car company. He did start the Maruti project, but didn't move very much.
But Maruti was not his ownership, right?
It was his ownership. It was a private company.
Yeah.
So it was set up
by him. It was owned by him.
Yeah, owned by him. Yeah, absolutely. And then he got loans from banks, RBI, changed the norms.
Yeah.
The K.R. Puri was the governor. He changed the banking regulation norms so that the Maruti gets the loan.
And how did Suzuki partnership happen at the same time?
This happened much later. So when Sanjay Gandhi died in 1980, this project was fatherless.
Okay.
So
and the company was also fatherless.
Company was fatherless.
He was essentially the CEO
essentially
of the company.
The CEO of the company. So when the company was without anybody to look after, Mrs. Gandhi decided that she wanted this company to survive.
Yeah.
And so she wanted to set it up in the public sector.
Yeah.
So she called some of our important professional managers. V. Krishnamurti was called in and he was given this responsibility to set up. V. Krishnamurti was then the BHEL man. So he was given the responsibility to set up this Maruti project in the public sector in foreign collaboration to produce a small car. So then it was set up in the public sector with a 26% equity stake from Suzuki, with a condition that in 5 years, Suzuki can raise its stake to 40%. And that's how Maruti Udyog Limited, it was called then. Maruti Udyog Limited, MUL, those days. Now, of course, Suzuki is the majority owner. It's called Maruti Suzuki. Yeah. So that's how it happened. Now, coming back to the RBI thing. So when K.R. Puri saw that there's a new regime, Morarji Desai is the prime minister and H.M. Patel is the finance minister. He was called to Delhi, but he would not come to Delhi. Finally, the finance minister had to call him to Delhi and tell him that you bring your resignation letter along with it. So H.M. Patel, K.R. Puri comes to Delhi very reluctantly, resigns, and already Morarji Desai has chosen his successor, a man called I.G. Patel. Now, I.G. Patel at that time was with the UN body, and he did not want to come immediately because he would have lost his pension if he didn't complete a certain number.
5 years.
5 years. So he wanted more time. So they had a stopgap arrangement in the banking sector.
Where they brought in intermediary for 7 months.
7 months. So M. Narasimham came in and he became the RBI governor. I.G. Patel came in, but he also had his problem with Morarji Desai, because Morarji Desai was saying that don't take R.K. Hazari as man, as your deputy and all that. But I.G. Patel said, nothing doing, I will keep him. And I.G. Patel actually told Morarji Desai that if you think that I am not the right person, you have an opinion, I have not yet become the RBI governor.
Yeah.
But Morarji Desai did not press the issue. So that differences of opinion were there. Then there was Manmohan Singh, who was the economic affairs secretary. And those days, the RBI governor would come and brief the government and the finance ministry about what kind of policies they're taking. In one such case, the RBI governor could not make it. So Manmohan Singh actually, as economic affairs secretary, actually told the RBI in no uncertain terms that you should always make sure that what you intend to do must be communicated to the government in writing. Don't take it lightly. So the finance ministry's relationship with the RBI has always been a little stressed. Then you come to later years.
Raghuram Rajan's case.
Yes, of course. Raghuram Rajan was appointed by the UPA government at a time when there was a global economic crisis there. He managed the situation well. But I think their relationship with the Narendra Modi government was strained. To be fair, Raghuram Rajan made some comments about government policies, which probably was out of brief.
Yes.
In the sense that the RBI governor should stay
in his role,
in his own this thing. And he did not do that. He talked about government's industrial policy, that policy. He also made some casual comments like India being a one-eyed giant. So these were not liked by the government. And when most probably when Raghuram Rajan got to know that the government is very keen on the demonetization of the 500 and 1,000 rupee notes, he agreed to let that process continue, because that process of demonetization was for about 6 months. But he decided to quit in June and left it.
2016.
He left in September. So his successor, Urjit Patel, came. He had to carry the load of demonetization. So he did that, but even he fell out with the government, because he wanted the public sector governance norms to be changed so that the RBI can monitor and regulate the public sector banks adequately. So there the differences of opinion arose. So he also had to quit suddenly. So the point I'm making is this, whether it is this government or the previous governments, whether it is the Morarji Desai government or it's the Nehru government, the tensions and stressful relations between the RBI and the RBI governor and the finance ministry and the prime minister and the thing is a story that is an ongoing saga.
And what about the current governor?
The current governor, remember, is a former IS officer. He has worked as in the finance ministry, as an economic affairs secretary in the finance ministry, and a trusted man. So he enjoys the trust of the government, and the equations so far are good. But even now, there are occasions where the RBI governor would talk about
how cryptocurrency is something that you should not touch with a barge pole, whereas the government on occasions have given a signal that probably cryptocurrencies are not that something that need to manage them well. So there are no major issues of discomfort or difference of opinion with this governor and the Narendra Modi government.
So we are ending touching towards the last 10 minutes of the podcast, right? I want to touch specifically upon P. Chidambaram as a finance minister, and then Pranab Mukherjee, right? How were they? What are the reforms they brought?
Well, you know, P. Chidambaram had two stints, three stints. One was from 1996 to 1998. That stint was marked at one level the way he implemented the reforms agenda, particularly on insurance sector, particularly with regard to government's the dismantling of the ad hoc treasury bill system, and the custom duty being brought down.
Yeah.
So I think he did it fairly well. At that time, it was a United Front government. And his second stint, Mr. Chidambaram's second stint, which will be featured in my third volume, he is from 2004 to 2008, and he has implemented the same reforms without any deviation of norms. But it's a fact that apart from reducing tariffs, keeping them stable, and apart from maintaining a stable tax rate, direct tax rate, and excise rates, what he failed to get was he could not get the kind of consensus building on GST. He did not. But his implementation of the state value added tax was very, very efficient. So it's a mixed picture. Then when he came back for his third stint from 2013 to 2014, he had a major challenge to deal with. The economy was in a crisis in a sense that because of the global financial crisis, the taper tantrum in the US and everything was affecting India. Once again, he brought in his own team and implemented and managed the economy quite competently. So Chidambaram is an efficient administrator, and there was stability, and he managed it quite competently.
And what about Pranab Mukherjee?
Pranab Mukherjee's stint is better known. His first stint was under Mrs. Gandhi. He's the only finance minister who has such a long gap between two of his stints.
Yes.
His first stint was in from 1982 to 84, and his second stint starts, believe it or not, in 2009.
Yeah.
So it's a huge 25-year gap.
Yes.
Now, but in the first stint, he had to defend India's taking the IMF loan. He got into a controversy over NRI controversy by bringing in Swaraj Paul to invest. It was a major controversy. Something similar happened in his second stint also. He introduced the so-called Vodafone tax, over which the succeeding years have been spent, and even now India faces a lack of confidence in the foreign investor because of that retrospective taxation. But by and large, Mr. Mukherjee reintroduced many of the discretionary policies, not completely rewriting the laws. But he brought in a lot of things that the Congress is known for, which is slightly tinge of socialism there.
And sir, what's your view, right? That since you touched upon Vodafone, our telecom has been a duopoly. Earlier, it was.
It has become a duopoly. Which is a very sad thing, because that's not the idea of a reform. This is something that should have been handled well. And I would say that even now, even though the government has now taken stake in Vodafone, we don't see, there are some signs of Vodafone raising resources from the market. is very important for a competitive market to operate and function. It should not be reduced to duopoly. We only hope that policies are geared to maintaining a competitive environment in the market.
Yeah, and I don't know whether it's a bad thing or a good thing, but Jio able to replace, because of low tariffs, such a large institution and so many retrospective taxes coming on Vodafone, it will not give foreign companies confidence that, hey, we can build a large company in India.
I couldn't agree with you more that, the regulator or the government should not be in the business of choosing the winners. There is a sense outside probably that in the last several years that if you want to do business in India, you need to be the chosen few, the national champion phenomenon.
Which was what government tried to de-establish in 91.
To dismantle.
Yeah.
So the national champion phenomenon does not inspire confidence among foreign investors to come in. So you need to have a kind of a collaborator here who would be a national champion here. And I don't think if you are looking at strategic sectors, if you're looking at a few sectors where you want to be a global champion, and for over a period of certain period of time, probably it is acceptable. But in a sector like telecom services, there is no need to have that national champion philosophy. You need to open up the space to anybody who has the financial muscle and the marketing access.
And so how would you rate, the last 10 years of finance ministry on various parameters?
I think you have to look at it in the first 5 years. I would say that the era of reforms, you had the GST, you had the insolvency and bankruptcy code in 2016. Even you had the real estate regulatory authority. You had by and large a resolution of the Vodafone tax crisis. So I would say and taxation, tax rates being rationalized, so that is the era of thing. The second phase began very promisingly with reduction in corporation tax rate and new direct taxes regime, but unfortunately COVID came in, and COVID was a century, one in century kind of a crisis. But I would say that the finance ministry handled the COVID crisis very competently and did not use government resources far too in excess to destroy fiscal balance of the economy, of the government. So you have handled the economy well. You have kept the fiscal deficit, even though it is slightly wide, you have kept the fiscal deficit under control. Growth has been purely investment led. Probably now that the COVID is behind us, finance ministry now will have to go back to a new phase of factor market reforms, many other reforms that are waiting to be done. GST 2 is waiting to be implemented, because GST is right now at a state where you've got multiple rates, your petrol and diesel is not part of it, you have a compensation system which has to be discontinued. So there's so much to be done on GST to make it an effective revenue neutral rate has to go up. So there's a lot of things, but I would say that because of the COVID for 3 years, the finance ministry was deep in the, into this crisis, and it managed it well, and now is the time to get back.
And
to
India didn't print money like the US.
Absolutely. So you kept the fisc under control, so that your fiscal deficit, it did go up to 9% 1 year, but it went brought down to 5.8 in the last financial year.
And as you interact with more foreign investors, do you see the confidence is increasing right now, or is it the same, or?
I think the confidence is increasing because India is probably the only bright spot. But along with the rise in confidence, there is also expectation that India will address its basic
bureaucratic,
judicial, ease of doing business, and plus employable youth. We are producing a large number of graduates, but many of them are not employable. So that's very important.
Yeah. I think it's a unique case study in itself because we can't copy China or we can't copy any other.
It has to be, you know, in that sense, I would say that we have to strike a new path, which probably a mix of manufacturing and high-end manufacturing led services.
And one area to, you know, I would like to summarize is that in the initial 1950s, when we started measuring our GDP, we were subscribed to Hindu rate of growth, which was 3.5% by P.C. Mahalanobis.
Yes.
I think it was
Rajkrishna.
Rajkrishna.
Yeah.
And it was Mr. Manmohan Singh who said, this is not okay. You need to grow at 7 to 8%.
That's right.
At least.
Absolutely.
Then our aspirations have changed for growth.
Yes, absolutely. I think it is good to be aspirational.
Yeah.
It is good to set targets.
Yeah.
But along with setting targets, you need to take those necessary steps to strengthen the infrastructure, to reform the processes, reform the policies so that those targets can become achievable.
And recently, the 7 to 8% growth is there, but it's also with, along with inflation of 7 to 8%.
Yeah. That's right. That's right.
Which is a bit alarming, but hopefully.
My sense is that the growth that you are talking about is real growth. So it does not have an impact of inflation. So, inflation rate needs to be kept under control. But this kind of, if you are growing by 7.5% growth rate, this is minus inflation. So this is the real growth. But your point is valid that inflation needs to be kept under check.
And do you see, because our aspiration is now to become, let's say, a $30 to $40 trillion economy over a decade or two. Is that possible for India?
Well, you know, theoretically.
Because you have seen the history over the last 45 years.
Theoretically, why not? But it all depends on the manner in which you're growing, the manner in which how soon you reach the end of your demographic dividend, and how soon the dollar rupee exchange rate perform, because this is target set in dollar terms. So I think it is a target that is surely can be achievable, but which year, I think is a matter of time that we can say.
Thank you so much, sir.
Thank you very much.
It was such an enjoyable conversation.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me. Yeah.
And it's been a pleasure. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Thank you.